More, a story by William Ford. Morris Silver was a 13-year-old midget who stood no taller than a kitchen table, and he weighed less than a normal 7-year-old boy. At the precise moment which marked the 14th anniversary of his birth, something very mysterious happened to him, and his life was never the same again. At birth, Morris was no different to other newborn infants. He was tiny, he had blue eyes, and was covered in pink crinkly skin, which loosely fitted his body, one size larger than his bones. Now, when he was content, the sounds coming out of his mouth would be bubble-wrapped. But when he got wet or hungry, the peaceful bubble would explode into an earth-shattering scream. Being an only child, his parents were naturally proud of him, and like all new parents, their greatest pleasure was to show him off to any passerby who cared to look. As the months and the years passed, his parents became increasingly concerned with his lack of growth. By the age of 3 years, he had the face of a 3-year-old, but he was no bigger than a child of one. The anxious parents spent thousands of pounds and travelled hundreds of miles, having their son examined by eminent child specialists. Apart from his smallness in size, for which no explanation could be found, not one of the child experts could find anything at all wrong with him. He was assessed as being happy, he was healthy, and in many ways more intelligent than a normal 3-year-old. His speech was well advanced for his age, and already he could read. Most of the child experts tried to reassure Morris's parents that, given time, there was no earthly reason why their son shouldn't grow up like other children. This provided a spark of hope for his parents, and during the next 3 years, Morris did grow 2 inches taller. When Morris was 6 years old, therefore, his parents had become resigned to the fact the son was a midget. Although disappointed with his dwarf-like size, Morris's parents loved him, and they began to make all the necessary changes to their home to provide for the comfort and safety of Little Mo, as he was to become affectionately known. Some household furniture needed to be in 2 sizes, normal and miniature, whilst many fixtures such as staircase handrails, doorknobs, light switches, coat hooks, all needed to be duplicated at high and low levels. Special handmade clothes also needed to be made to prevent him from looking too babyish. Little Mo started first school 10 months later than he ought to have done. The problem was that they refused to admit him because they couldn't believe he was as old as his parents claimed. After the initial admittance hiccup, however, he sailed through the following 7 years at first and then middle school. Being a boy of pleasing and kind disposition, he quickly became well-liked and accepted by his classmates and teachers. Little Mo was almost 14 years old now, and next week he was due to start at his new school, Marfield High Boys School. Marfield High was a good school, with a well-established tradition for combining good examination results with a wide coverage of sports and athletics. Being a lover of most sports, Little Mo looked forward to this big change in his school life, but there was no way he could have anticipated the very unsettled start he got off to. Well, he got through the first week at Marfield High without too many difficulties. There were a great many new faces to get used to, and new routines and school rules to learn, but on the whole, he settled in reasonably well. He was naturally a curiosity specimen for those other pupils who had never before met a midget, but that quickly passed. Being small in size, pleasant in nature, he presented no threat to anyone. During the second week at the new school, all the first-year newcomers quickly learned that a third-year tyrant stalked the school. All sorts of gruesome stories were exchanged about this beast that everyone sensible avoided conflict with. Basher Braithwaite. He was a 15-year-old mean-looking monster who had a 3-inch scar across his right cheek. This incredible hulk of menacing flesh and his 6 minders terrorised the first and second years at Marfield High. Even the teachers took a wide berth of him and his foul-mouthed temper. Basher ran a protection racket that coined in more money weekly than the corner sweet shop, and to which membership was compulsory to all first and second years. It was rumoured that even some of the more timid teaching staff paid the weekly levy, which guaranteed that their undamaged parked cars remained parked and undamaged during their absence. Basher had his protection scam off to a fine art, and assisted by his 6 faithful cronies, he used every terrorising trick in the book to ensure that it ran smoothly. Newcomers to Marfield High were left alone during their first week at school, lulled into a false sense of security. During the second week, however, they would experience lost, damaged or stolen property. Everyone knew, or if they didn't know, they'd soon find out, that the Braithwaite mob were responsible. But nobody dared to confront them or report them to members of staff because nothing could be proved. By the end of the second week at school, all the newcomers would have been informed by the second-yearers of the system they were now part of. Every Monday morning, the Braithwaite mob mounted guard at the school entrance gates. All the first and all the second-yearers would be herded through the side gates in single file. These were the levy payers, who added £60 a week to Basher's private bank account. As each boy walked through the poll tax corridor like frightened sheep, the first attendance count of the day would commence, with the tyrant himself making the register in his little black book. Just to remind any boy having second thoughts about paying the levy, the Braithwaite mob pounded out a message of intimidation in the palm of their hands with a short, thick piece of wood. Without one word being spoken, every first yearer would hand over 50 pence to one of the Braithwaite mob, and every second yearer 25 pence. As each boy passed by the Praetorian Guard, Basher would tick their names off in his black book and let them through. The rules were simple and everybody understood them. You paid your levy without being asked for it and without any fuss. Any boy absent from the Monday roll call for any reason was given a 24-hour deadline to seek Basher out and pay up, along with a 10 pence inconvenience fine. Refuse to pay the levy and you were a dead duck. Pay the levy on demand and Basher would provide you with 1 week's guaranteed protection from his own heavy mob. Basher was no mug when it came to assessing risk. His father, who was serving 7 years for armed robbery and had taught him the ground rules inside out, Bruiser Braithwaite, he told his son when he first heard of the school protection scam, "If you don't ask for the money, son, they'll have a tough time trying to do you for extortion." Another piece of advice Bruiser had given his son was, "Never underestimate the power of fear." Well, Basher had learnt his trade in terrorisation well, and he milked it for every penny it was worth. He also knew, however, which side his bread was buttered on, and he didn't want to risk the collapse of a very lucrative racket through expulsion. Neither did he want the boys in blue from the local cop shop nosing around his patch, or else it would blow the lid on the other illegal activities he and his cronies were engaged in. The tyrant had, therefore, figured it out that by giving second-yearers the incentive of paying the reduced 25 pence levy, he could count on them to keep first-yearers in line and discourage them from bucking the Braithwaite system. Any first-yearer refusing to pay the levy would be duffed up daily until he paid, and would be kept on the full weekly levy of 50 pence during the second year instead of obtaining the concessionary rate of 25 pence. Thus, by the twin combination of terrorisation and incentives, he was able to keep his protection racket intact. No exceptions to the rule could be tolerated. Thus the word went round to all newcomers by the end of their second week at Marfield High, "Don't buck the system, pay up and shut up." On the Monday morning of the third week at Marfield High, first and second yearers filed through the entrance gate. They all paid their levy to one of the Braithwaite mob. Little Moore thought he had slipped by when he was collared by the tyrant himself. His path forward was blocked as this incredible lump of ferocious muscle towered over him with a menacing face and outstretched open palm, silently inviting him to join the list of levy payers. Pretending not to see him, Little Moore sidestepped and tried to go round Basher. Sensing he had a rebel on his hands, Basher broke his golden rule and said, "Pay your levy, you miserable midget, or else." Little Moore, feeling intimidated, instinctively reached down inside his trouser pocket to extract a 50 pence coin. But as he did so, his mind was telling him loud and clear, "Don't do it, Moore. Don't pay that tyrant." Meanwhile, the queue of levy payers behind him was growing in size and were curious to know what was holding them up. Taking a very deep breath and swallowing his fear, Little Moore looked up at this self-appointed poll tax collector and in a loud, clear voice said, "You'll get no money off me, Basher, not one penny."
Well, the tyrant's face flushed scarlet with anger, and he raised his right fist, determined to knock little Moore's head clean off his shoulders.
And the assembly bell rang. With steel-ribbed eyes and gorging veins bursting to explode, Basher spat out a crooked laugh and said,
"I'll see you later, you pint-sized pipsqueak. I'll see you later."
Word spread around Marfield High like a blazing fire that the midget had refused to pay the levy. Nobody talked about anything else that day except to speculate what kind of hideous punishment the Braithwaite mob would inflict upon this foolish miniature rebel.
"I wouldn't be in his shoes for all the money in Marfield," exclaimed one second yearer.
"Basher'll tear his head off and pulp it into mincemeat," said another one.
Little Moore found it difficult to concentrate on his schoolwork that day, and when the final bell went, every classroom was evacuated double-fast, all by its occupants, and Little Moore left the empty classroom all by himself, his classmates already congregating by the main gate, waiting with bated breath and fearful expectation for the impending massacre. The lonely little rebel walked towards the crowded throng, and a mighty roar of "Here he comes now!" broke the deafening silence. As he pushed his frail body through the crowded entrance, his heart was pounding and he was feeling dizzy with the many different thoughts flashing through his head, fighting for space in the front of his mind. One moment later, two members of the Braithwaite mob pinned him up against the wall in a choked position, leaving him gasping for breath while Basher moved in for the kill. Little Moore had to think clearly and quickly if he was to save his bacon. He knew that he had no chance of tangling rough with this bone-crushing bulldozer and living to tell the tale. So he decided to take full advantage of the watching crowd and play for time.
"Come here, you little torag," yelled Basher as his brutish body loomed nearer. "I'll teach you to cross me, you insignificant little toad."
Well, as the two Braithwaite minders lessened their grip on Little Moore, he wriggled free and dropped to the ground. Addressing Basher in the most confident of voices, he said,
"If you insist on fighting me, Basher, don't do it like a coward. Do it alone and do it in the ring."
Well, Basher's blood boiled over. His rage fumed inside him at this little scab-infected ant who dared to call him a coward, this wafer-thin weakling who had refused to pay the levy and challenged him to boot. He felt like knocking his block off there and then. Basher squatted down with one arm outstretched. He lifted Little Moore clean off his feet with a one-handed throttle hold and said,
"4 o'clock tomorrow in the gym, you moth-eaten maggot, and I'm going to have your guts for garters."
As Basher and his cronies went off laughing loudly, the spectating crowd stood there, looking at Little Moore with mixed emotions. Some were proud of his brave stand and admired him for doing what they feared to do. Others thought that he'd flipped his lid. A few bystanders started taking bets upon whether or not he would show up at the gym tomorrow, while one observer was giving 2-to-1 odds that he wouldn't show up at school ever again. As Little Moore made his way home, he realised that he had bought himself some time to think things out. But all of that didn't change the fact he still had to face that tyrant again tomorrow at 4 o'clock. He arrived home half dazed by the challenge he had publicly issued to Basher and had clearly forgotten that tomorrow would be his 14th birthday. That evening, Little Moore's parents could sense he had something on his mind. He had been quieter than his usual self, and he had hardly touched his tea. Not that he ever ate much anyway, his appetite being proportionate to his size. His parents simply put it down to pre-birthday jitters. He went upstairs to bed to settle down for the night. His bedroom was arranged so that as he lay in his bed, he was able to look out of the window to the hillside beyond. He often fell asleep, gazing at the night-time sky. With half of his mind on the Braithwaite bully, the other half on the knowledge that tomorrow he'd be 14 years old, he looked at the wall clock. It was 10 p.m. exactly. Little Moore began to think about the precise moment of his birth, as he had often heard people say how important those details were. It was something to do with planets and whether or not they were coming here or whether they were going there. He began to wonder how it was possible for the astrological position of planets to determine the type of person someone would be for the whole of their lives, just because they happened to be born during one month or another. If a month, a week, a day could make a difference, why not 1 minute, he thought. He knew that he had been born precisely 1 minute after midnight, as his mother would remind him every birthday. If you had been born 1 minute earlier, Morris, your birthday would have been celebrated yesterday instead of today. She always said it. Many times little Moore had half wondered whether or not the precise moment of his birth had determined him to be born a midget. Perhaps his astrological planet had been in the process of passing through some time warp or black hole in space when I was born, he thought. Ah, well. He decided, for reasons quite unknown to him, that he would stay awake and see his birthday in, like adults do on New Year's Eve. So he took out a book and began to read, and the clock hand moved on nearer and nearer the precise anniversary of his birth. As the clock chimed midnight, little Moore decided to count down the last minute. He had reached 5 seconds from zero when he noticed through his window a brilliant light flash across the hillside beyond. On the count of zero, he realised that it was a shooting star. As he gazed upon it in wonderment, he made a silent wish. "Oh, I wish I had your breathtaking power and speed. Then I'd be able to deal that bone-crushing Braithwaite bully a humiliating blow." No sooner than little Moore had silently expressed his thoughtful wish, he sensed a massive surge of energy enter his body. His muscle veins swelled and tightened within the flesh, containing them, while his mind spun round like a one-armed bandit in jackpot motion. As he fixed his gaze through the bedroom window, he saw the reflection of his own face looking back at him. He noticed that his eyes had turned guinea pig red. Then all went blank, and instant sleep overcame him. Morning came, and little Moore awoke with an eagerness to get up and face the day ahead. Although still a midget in size, his inner being vibrated with an energy force that felt like a volcano immediately prior to discharge. He leapt out of bed, but as his feet touched the ground, the floorboard shook and shattered beneath him, causing a hole as large as a dustbin lid to appear. As he strode across the landing towards the bathroom, he felt 6 feet tall. Normally, he needed to apply the combined force of both hands to turn the sink tap, especially if his dad had been the last one to use it. He placed his right hand round the faucet and gripped it tightly. Before he could attempt to turn it, it disintegrated in the palm of his hand. Little Moore wondered what in blazes was happening to him as he came downstairs for breakfast and to open all his birthday cards and his present. After he had seen to his present, he looked towards his mother and said, "Any breakfast, Mum? I'm starving." His mother gave him a look of sheer astonishment, as she had never before heard her son ask for food. Usually, she would have to force him to eat something before he went to school. That morning, little Moore's appetite would have done justice to the stomach demands of an Olympic weightlifter. He ate 2 heaped bowls of cereal, 3 boiled eggs, 6 slices of toast and 1 large kipper. His mother could not believe her eyes and thought he had caught a worm. She looked him over with the sixth sense of a mother, and while she knew there was something different about him, she didn't know what it was. Somehow, though, she could sense that he seemed more alive. As little Moore went to school, he felt great. Partway there, he noticed before him a tin can that someone had previously poised upright to kick, but had left it undisturbed. He casually swung his right foot gently back and kicked the can. The metal container rose in the air like a launching rocket and soared towards the sky. It was still airborne when little Moore lost sight of it completely. "Whatever's happening to me?" asked little Moore, who by this time was gradually appreciating the power inside his body had multiplied many times. He passed a building site where he picked up a building brick with ease, one-handed. He had initially intended to test his strength by hurling it as far as he could. Deciding, however, that such an act was unsafe and irresponsible, he instead squeezed the brick, increasing the power of his grip upon it. As little Moore applied full pressure, the brick shattered into tiny particles in his hand, and when he squeezed harder, the contents of his hand turned into red dust. There was no mistaking it. Somehow he had acquired the strength of a superhuman. A fire engine with screeching siren passed by at great speed, and little Moore began to run after it to get rid of some of this energy in his body. He ran and ran, and the more his mind demanded of his legs, the more they energetically responded.
The fire engine raced on, and Little Moor had caught it up and began to run alongside it. By now, the fire engine must have been travelling at 60 miles an hour, and so was Little Moor.
He stopped to sit down on a nearby low-level wall to think things out. There were many unanswered questions racing around in his mind, and he pondered upon this mighty transformation that had occurred within him. Where was the power coming from? Why was it there? Was it confined only to his hands and his legs? How long would it last? What did it mean? As he approached the school gate entrance, the heavy wrought iron gate to the narrow side path was almost closed. He would test his body powers once more, just to satisfy himself that he wasn't imagining these strange goings-on inside him. He thought about blowing the heavy gate open with the power of his breath alone. So he concentrated, 5 feet away from the gate, took a deep breath, held it in his lungs for a moment, and then forcefully expelled it from his mouth toward the gate. To his utter amazement, yet to his inner satisfaction, the heavy gate swung open and loudly rebounded once it had travelled its full stretch. Little Moor entered assembly that morning fully preoccupied with the mystical transformation of power his body had undergone, and he hadn't given one thought to the challenge he had issued yesterday. Later, his mind turned to thoughts of Basha Braithwaite, and with those thoughts returned a feeling of unease, fear and apprehension of what would face him in the gym at 4 o'clock today. During the course of the day, Little Moore's mind began to contemplate the significance of the wondrous changes which had happened to him since 12:01 a.m. Every now and then, wicked thoughts came to his mind of different ways of hurting the tyrant. He thought about breaking his ribs by one blow to the stomach, or lifting him clear out of the boxing ring with an almighty uppercut to the chin. Gradually, however, Little Moore was obliged to conclude that with the power came responsibility to discharge it humanely, and the possession of superpower made the responsibility super great. While superhuman strength could be put to all manner of good use, it could also be proved to be highly dangerous, if not controlled and precisely applied. Cool. What if I hit Basha so hard I broke his jaw? I caused him to go blind, or I killed him, thought Little Moore. Well, by the end of the day, Little Moore had made a number of very important decisions, besides having discovered other aspects of his lightning speed, his gigantic strength and his powerful breath. The most important decision he had made was to humiliate Basha and not to hurt him, other than taking him down a peg or two in public, and that would hurt him enough. Next, he decided he would keep his superpowers a secret. This involved him devising ways of disguising his powers from the eyes of onlookers. He needed to be able to make things happen without anyone else realising that he was the cause. Little Moore was a midget, but by and large he was accepted by most of his classmates without him feeling like a freak at all. It was one thing to be a midget who was a curiosity factor that quickly passed with the passage of time. It was quite another thing, however, to be seen and known as a mighty midget. Little Moore had therefore concluded that were his secret ever to get out, he would draw more attention to himself than a circus freak and would never know a moment's peace again. The final decision he made was the need to find out the full extent of his powers and to practice using them with precision until he was able to exercise full control over them. While everyone else at school that day was buzzing with talk of the 4 o'clock massacre and placing bets upon whether Little Moore would finish up in the hospital or in the morgue, he was testing out his powers of breathing, speed, strength, and he was doing it all very inconspicuously. Little Moore found that each of his superpowers were far greater than he had first realised, and a whole range of new possibilities opened up for him on how he could produce a humiliating defeat over the Braithwaite bully. Little Moore discovered that by changing the pace, the depth, the pattern of his breathing, he was able to achieve control over the movements of objects and people. Not only was he able to blow heavy objects forward by forceful exhalation, but he could magnetise them back towards him by sucking his breath in. He even discovered that were he to shape his mouth and create a whooshing sound with a forceful blow, he was able to turn heavy objects around or even put them into a dizzy spin. By the end of the day, Little Moore was able to use his breathing power like a hurricane, a tornado or a giant vacuum cleaner. He found that from a distance of 100 yards he could stop a person running towards him, he could spin the person round, and if he chose to, blow him in the opposite direction. When Little Moore tested out the true power of his speed, he found that if he really concentrated his mind, he was able to travel faster than the speed of light. Little did he know that that morning, as he was racing along the fire engine, he could have beaten it hands down without using a fraction of his speed power. To give you an idea how fast the speed of light is, imagine looking at a boy stood still in the middle of a playground and not taking your eyes off him for even 2 seconds. Were the boy able to travel faster than light, it would be possible for him to run across the playground, touch the boundary wall, run back, and you would not see him move. This was truly stupendous power that opened up many possibilities. When Little Moore tested out the full extent of his strength, his power, he realised how wise he had been to decide upon humiliating Basher Braithwaite instead of trying to hurt him. He discovered that he could raise the school porter cabin classroom off the foundation with one hand, but toward the end of the day, while in the boiler house, he truly realised the extent of this awesome power. He was messing about with a piece of coal in his hand at the time, and as his thoughts turned to the tyrant he was soon to do battle with, he squeezed the lump of coal in the palm of his hand with all of his might. When he opened his fist, he was astounded to find he had transformed the lump of coal into a solid diamond. These three powers were fantastic powers, beyond the wildest imagination of any human being, and Little Moore could hardly wait to try them out on the tyrant racketeer at 4 o'clock that day. There was still one problem, however, that Little Moore had to overcome. If he was to keep his fantastic powers a secret, he needed to find some way of disguising his eyes, or rather, the blood-red colour of his eyes when he was using his powers. You see, Little Moore's body powers were controlled by his mind. Before he could get the power of breath, the power of speed, the power of strength into his body, he needed to think about what he wanted to do in his mind. The problem was that as Little Moore thought about his powers, his eyes began to turn bright red. The more power he needed in his body, the harder he had to think about it, and the redder his eyes became. It, therefore, became necessary that he devise a way of camouflaging his eyes and concealing the redness from the watchful crowd. The final bell went, and as the rest of the school made their way towards the gym to get a seat to see the contest, Little Moore began to make his final preparation. News of the boxing match had been cleverly kept away from the ears of the teaching staff, as two of the senior prefect boys had simply told the teachers they wanted to practice their football skills indoors to prepare for their semi-final soccer match against the Berkby Babes next month. They were able to get away with this deception as their sports instructor, Coach Wilson, was away from school with flu that day. While the gym filled to capacity with the pupils at Marfield High, Little Moore was making his final preparations in the art class. He entered the art class and he stripped to the nude. Once naked, he painted his entire body from head to foot in blazing red. When he had finished, the only unpainted part of his body were his eyes. After the paint had dried, he dressed and walked towards the gym where he got into the boxing ring that had been set up there. The deafening noise of the crowd that greeted Little Moore as he entered the gym quickly changed to total silence. The silence lasted but mere moments, after which hysterical fits of laughter broke out as everyone stared at his all-red appearance. Even Basher, who was sitting in the ring corner, looked gobsmacked at the extraordinary sight of the red midget who was being hoisted up into the ring. An onlooker yelled out, as he pointed towards Little Moore, "The midget's trying to blind Basher into submission." Another boy shouted, "Here's a feather, Moore. Now show us your war dance." Little Moore smiled a secret smile as he placed his tiny hands inside the pair of miniature boxing gloves which one of the prefects had managed to borrow for the contest. Basher stood up and looked across at Little Moore. He shook his fist at him violently and snarled across the ring, "You can paint your body any colour you want to, you moth-eaten magpie. Nothing's going to disguise the blood that's going to flow once I start cutting you to ribbons." Little Moore remained unmoved by Basher's taunts and threats. He had indeed painted his body red to disguise, not blood, but the colour of his eyes once he began to use his superpowers. When both contestants were ready for battle to commence, the prefect, who was officiating as the fight referee, called both towards the centre of the ring to remind them, and everybody else, of the rules. The referee said out loud, "This is a contest of 10 3-minute rounds, which will be fought in the Marquis of Queensbury rules.
That means no biting, no kicking, no spitting, no hair-pulling, no eye-thumbing, no other manner of foul blow. Because little Moore is so small and doesn't stand taller than the waistline of his opponent, the hitting below the belt rule will not apply to him. Three knockdowns in any single round or one knockout will end the fight. Should the fight go the full distance, the audience will decide the winner by a show of hands. Do you both understand?
Both Basher and Little Moore signified their understanding with a nod of the head, after which the referee said,
Go to your respective corner, and when the bell rings, come out fighting.
The bell rang for the first round, and Basher came out of his corner like a raging bull, determined to finish the midget off in the opening minute. He lashed out with an avalanche of fearsome blows at Little Moore, but they missed his head by a mile. They were too high. This frustrated Basher immediately, besides wasting quite a bit of his energy. Little Moore had planned his fight strategy right down to the final detail. It worked perfectly. First, he planned to make Basher miss his target by a mile. This would get him angry and would encourage Basher to put more energy into his blows. After a couple of rounds of punching air, Little Moore reckoned that Basher would begin to get more and more frustrated. The more frustrated he got, the angrier he would become. Providing Little Moore could prevent him from landing a glove on him, Basher would quickly tire. Once tired, Little Moore intended to rub salt into the wounds of the bully's pride by making him look clumsy and ridiculous. Next, Little Moore planned to unbalance the great oaf and finally to humiliate him before the crowd of spectators. By round four, the tyrant was tiring quickly with punching fresh air. His head was becoming dizzy with missing his target. Each time he lashed out his great shovel-sized fist, he just hit nothing. In round five, Little Moore made Basher look a right fool by ducking through his legs at lightning speed as he came towards him and then pulling down the bully's boxing shorts before ducking back through the legs once more. The crowd howled with laughter as they pointed to the red-faced Basher stood in the centre of the ring with his shorts round his ankles and his bottom bare for all to see. The bell sounded and that was the end of the fifth. As both contestants were sitting in the corner, Little Moore looked across at the Braithwaite bully and for a brief moment he began to feel sorry for him. Basher gave Little Moore a murderous look, and Moore decided that the fight would not go beyond round seven. Round six started, and Little Moore knew that this was a round where he would use the combination of Basher's tiredness, frustration, and anger to topple him. His plan involved allowing Basher's blows to come closer and closer to his own head without hitting it, and then tempting Basher to launch a haymaker. By now the crowd could sense that something spectacular was happening before their eyes, and they got behind Little Moore as they began cheering loudly for his victory. To see Basher lose was a dream in itself, but to see the Braithwaite brawler lose to a mere midget without one blow having been struck by either contestant was nothing short of a miracle. As the crowd shouted, they cheered, began to root for Little Moore, Basher became angrier and angrier at being outsmarted and outmaneuvered by this dwarf-like upstart. As Little Moore allowed the monstrous blows of his opponent to approach his head even nearer and nearer, Basher determined to throw a haymaker at the first opportunity. Everything he had, every last ounce of energy, was to be put into one almighty blow that would knock the midget into the middle of next week. Basher approached Moore, and both contestants had blood in their eyes as Little Moore began to concentrate upon the superpowers he needed to use to execute his master plan. Little Moore was ready to persuade Basher. Now was the ideal moment to launch his haymaker. Little Moore stepped back two paces and lowered his guard. Basher took the bait and unleashed a haymaker straight toward the head of Little Moore. Little Moore concentrated his mind as the blow came towards him, and by using the power of his lightning speed at the last moment, he made the push miss, and that threw Basher off balance. Once Basher had missed and was unsteady on his feet, Little Moore blasted him with a 4-7 breath of air. It spun him round seven times, leaving him dizzy. The bell rang for the end of the sixth, and Basher was totally disorientated and waddling around the ring like a drunken duck. As the bell went to start the seventh round, Basher was looking like a spent force, and he sat slumped in the corner. Little Moore got up from his corner quickly, went to the middle of the ring and prepared to humiliate the tyrant once and for all. As Basher tried to stand up, he found that he couldn't budge his body off the corner stool. It felt as if he was sitting in a wind tunnel of the Concorde Aerodrome, and he couldn't for the life of him figure out why he was unable to stand up. Meanwhile, Little Moore simply stood in the centre of the ring, looking across at Basher in the corner, but secretly blowing powerful breath towards him. The crowd went hush quiet as they saw Little Moore standing there, whilst his opponent Basher remained seated in his corner, refusing to come out for the seventh round. They didn't know that it was Little Moore's breathing that was preventing Braithwaite rising. They simply thought he'd had enough. The crowd began to go wild and somebody yelled, "He's had enough! The midget has beaten him!" Upon hearing this, Basher's seconds thought that something serious must be wrong, so they threw the towel into the ring. The fight was over. The bully had been defeated. The frenzy of the crowd increased as it began to dawn on them the miracle they'd just witnessed, the downfall of the Goliath by the slingless David. The referee moved towards the centre of the ring to pronounce Little Moore the winner with the words, "I declare Little Moore, no, I mean Mighty Moore, the winner of this contest in the seventh round." A mighty chant went up from every first and second yearer in the crowd, and it reverberated round the gym and told the Braithwaite mob their reign of terror at Marfield High was effectively ended, and the days of Basher's protection racket were now numbered. "Three cheers for Moore! No more levy! Three cheers for Moore! No more levy! Three cheers for Moore! No more levy!" The shame of it all was too much for Basher and his cronies to bear. They left the school premises that day and never again showed their faces at Marfield High. The sheer humiliation of it all was just too much. Everyone in the school knew that the midget had outfaced him, outboxed him, and outfoxed him. Moore's 14th year of life spent at Marfield High was the happiest and most memorable year he ever knew. Being accepted, being respected and well-loved by everybody meant that he no longer gave a second thought to his midget size, and neither did anyone else. As he lay in bed during the eve of his 15th birthday, he looked out to the hills beyond and decided to stay awake and see in his birthday again. He was also curious to discover if the shooting star would return at the appointed time. As the anniversary of his birth approached, Moore's thoughts focused upon the marvellous year he had spent at Marfield. The clock chimed midnight, and as it did so, Moore fixed his eyes intensely on the moonlit hills. At precisely 12:01 a.m, his shooting star reappeared and made its majestic journey across the nighttime sky, following the same path as it had done the previous year. As the planetary messenger passed by, Moore made another silent wish, a final wish. "Thank you for the powers you gave me, but please take them back and make me a normal boy once more." No sooner than Moore had expressed his wish, he sensed a tremendous surge of energy leave his body, to be replaced by a new and different form of peaceful energy that swept over him like waves of tranquility. His eyes turned from deep red and moved through the different colour spectrums until they eventually settled in the shade of blue. They then closed peacefully, and Moore fell asleep contented. The next morning, Moore awoke to start the 15th year of his life as a normal boy, no longer possessing the power of lightning speed and gigantic strength. To kick a can now was to invite a bruised toe. Were he to squeeze a building brick with all his might, he might cut his hands. When he blew vigorously at heavy objects, they remained unmoved, and to squeeze a lump of coal in the palm of his hand would leave its composition unchanged, just as a piece of coal. And yet Moore was happy that all this was as it was. Something strange, however, did happen to Moore during the years ahead. It was nothing unusual to a normal boy, and yet for Moore, most strange. At first it went virtually unnoticed, but in time it became more apparent that Moore's body was growing taller and larger. By the time he had reached the age of 16 years, he was almost normal-sized completely. Moore stayed on at Marfield High until he was 18 years old, and during his 16th year, he even earned a place in the Marfield Marauders, the school football team. He enjoyed a full and happy life, but without doubt his 14th year at Marfield High was the one year he would never forget.